Are you taking care of them too? Or only Karoli and I? No reply. You're not very talkative tonight, Melantha observed. I'm under strain, his voice replied. And certain things you are safer not to know. Go to bed, Melantha Jurl. We've talked long enough. All right, Captain, she said. She smiled at the ghost and lifted her hand. His own rose to meet it. Warm dark flesh and pale radiance brushed, melded, were one. Melantha Jurl turned to go. It was not until she was out in the corridor, safe in the light once more, that she began to tremble. False Midnight. The talks had broken up, and one by one the academicians had gone to bed. Even Karoli DeBrannon had retired, his appetite for chocolate quelled by his memories of the lounge. The linguists had made violent, noisy love before giving themselves up to sleep, as if to reaffirm their life in the face of Tala Lassimer's grisly death. Rojan Christophorus had listened to music, but now they were all still. The night flyer was filled with silence. In the darkness of the largest cargo hold, three sleep webs hung side by side. Melantha Jurl twisted occasionally in her sleep, her face feverish, as if in the grip of some nightmare. Alice Northwind lay flat on her back, snoring loudly, a reassuring wheeze of noise from her solid, meaty chest. Lami Thorne lay awake, thinking. Finally, she rose and dropped to the floor, nude, quiet, light, and careful as a cat. She pulled on a tight pair of pants, slipped a wide-sleeved shirt of black metallic cloth over her head, belted it with a silver chain, shook out her short hair. She did not don her boots. Barefoot was quieter. Her feet were small and soft, with no trace of callus. She moved to the middle sleep web and shook Alice Northwind by her shoulder. The snoring stopped abruptly. Huh? The Xenotech said. She grunted in annoyance. Come, whispered Lami Thorne. She beckoned. Northwind got heavily to her feet, blinking, and followed the cyberneticist through the door out into the corridor. She'd been sleeping in her jumpsuit. It seemed open nearly to her crotch. She frowned and sealed it. What the hell? She muttered. She was disarrayed and unhappy. There's a way to find out if Vord's story was true, Lami Thorne said carefully. Melantha won't like it, though. Are you game to try? What? Northwind asked. Her face betrayed her interest. Come, the cyberneticist said. They moved silently through the ship to the computer room. The system was up, but dormant. They entered quietly, all empty. Currents of light ran silkily down crystalline channels in the data grids, meeting, joining, splitting apart again. Rivers of wan, multi-hued radiance crisscrossing a black landscape. The chamber was dim, the only noise a buzz at the edge of human hearing. Until Lami Thorne moved through it, touching keys, tripping switches, directing the silent, luminescent currents. Bit by bit, the machine woke.
What are you doing? Alice Northwind said.
Karoli told me to tie in our system with the ship, Lami Thorne replied as she worked. I was told Roy wanted to study the Volcran data. Fine, I did it.
Do you understand what that means?
Her shirt whispered in soft metallic tones when she moved. Eagerness broke across the flat features of Xenotech Alice Northwind.
The two systems are tied together.
Exactly. So Royd can find out about the Volcran, and we can find out about Royd. She frowned. I wish I knew more about the Nightflyer's hardware, but I think I can feel my way through. This is a pretty sophisticated system DeBrannon requisitioned.
Can you take over from Eris?
Take over? Mommy sounded puzzled.
You've been drinking again, Alice?
No, I'm serious.
Use your system to break into the ship's control. Overwhelm Eris. Countermand his orders. Make the Night Flyer respond to us down here. Wouldn't you feel safer if we were in control?
Maybe, the cyberneticist said doubtfully. I could try, but why do that?
Just in case. We don't have to use the capacity just so we have it if an emergency arises.
Lami Thorne shrugged. emergencies and gas giants. I only want to put my mind at rest about Royd, whether he had anything to do with killing Lassimer. She moved over to a readout panel where a half-dozen meter-square view screens curved around a console and brought one of them to life. Long fingers ghosted through the holographic keys that appeared and disappeared as she used them, the keyboard changing shape again and yet again. The cyberneticist's pretty face grew thoughtful and serious. "We're in," she said. Characters began to flow across a view screen, red flickerings in glassy black depths. On a second screen, a schematic of the Night Flyer appeared, revolved, halved. Its spheres shifted size and perspective at the whim of Lami's fingers, and a line of numerals below gave the specifications. The cyberneticist watched, and finally froze both screens. "Here," she said. "Here's my answer about the hardware. You can dismiss your takeover idea, unless those gas giant people of yours are going to help. The Nightfly is bigger and smarter than our little system here. Makes sense when you stop to think about it. Ships all automated, except for Royd." Her hands moved again, and two more display screens stirred. Lami Thorne whistled and coaxed her search program with soft words of encouragement. "It looks as though there is a Royd, though. Configurations are all wrong for a robot ship. Damn, I would have bet anything." The characters began to flow again, Lami watching the figures as they drifted by. "Here's life support specs. Might tell us something." A finger jabbed and one screen froze yet again.
"Nothing unusual," Alice Northwind said in disappointment.
"Standard waste disposal, water recycling, food processor with protein and vitamin supplements in stores." She began to whistle. "Tanks of Rennie's moss and neograss to eat up the CO2. Oxygen cycle then. No methane or ammonia. Sorry about that.
Go sex with a computer."
The cyberneticist smiled. "Ever tried it?" Her fingers moved again. "What else should I look for? You're the tech. What would be a giveaway? Give me some ideas."
"Check the specs for nurturing tanks, cloning equipment, that sort of thing," the Xenotech said. "That would tell us whether he was lying."
"I don't know," Lami Thorne said. "Long time ago, he might have junked that stuff. No use for it."
"Find Royd's life history," Northwind said. "His mother's. Get a readout on the business they've done, all this alleged trading. They must have records. Account books, profit and loss, cargo invoices, that kind of thing."
Her voice grew excited and she gripped the cyberneticist from behind by her shoulders.
"A log, a ship's log. There's gotta be a log. Find it."
"All right." Lami Thorne whistled, happy, at ease with her system, riding the data winds, curious, in control. Then the screen in front of her turned a bright red and began to blink. She smiled, touched a ghost key, and the keyboard melted away and reformed under her. She tried another tack. Three more screens turned red and began to blink. Her smile faded.
"What is it?"
"Security," said Lami Thorne. "I'll get through it in a second. Hold on." She changed the keyboard yet again, entered another search program, attached on a rider in case it was blocked. Another screen flashed red. She had her machine chew the data she gathered, sent out another feeler. More red. Flashing. Blinking. Bright enough to hurt the eyes. All the screens were red now. "A good security program," she said with admiration. "The log is well protected." Alice Northwind grunted.
"Are we blocked?"
"Response time is too slow," Lami Thorne said, chewing on her lower lip as she thought. "There's a way to fix that." She smiled and rolled back the soft black metal of her sleeve.
"What are you doing?"
"Watch," she said. She slid her arm under the console, found the prongs, jacked in. "Ah," she said low in her throat. The flashing red blocks vanished from her readout screens, one after the other, as she sent her mind coursing into the Night Flyer system, easing through all the blocks. Nothing like slipping past another system security. Like slipping onto a man. Log entries were flickering past them in a whirling, blurring rush, too fast for Alice Northwind to read, but Lami read them. Then she stiffened. "Oh," she said. It was almost a whimper. "Cold," she said. She shook her head and it was gone. But there was a sound in her ears, a terrible whooping sound. "Damn," she said. That'll wake everyone. She glanced up when she felt Alice's fingers dig painfully into her shoulder, squeezing, hurting. A gray steel panel slid almost silently across the access to the corridor, cutting off the whooping cry of the alarm.
What? Lummi Thorne said. That's an emergency air seal, said Alice Northwind in a dead voice.
She knew starships.
It closes where they're about to load or unload cargo in vacuum.
Their eyes went to the huge curving outer airlock above their heads. The inner lock was almost completely open, and as they watched, it clicked into place, and the seal on the outer door cracked, and now was open half a meter, sliding, and beyond was twisted nothingness so burning bright it seared the eyes.
Oh, said Lummi Thorne, as the cold coursed up her arm.
She had stopped whistling. Alarms were hooting everywhere. The passengers began to stir. Melantha Gerald tumbled from her sleep web and darted into the corridor, nude, frantic, alert. Caroli DeBrannon sat up drowsily. The Psy-Psych muttered fitfully in drug-induced sleep. Rajan Christophorus cried out in alarm. Far away, metal crunched and tore, and a violent shudder ran through the ship, throwing the linguists out of their sleep webs, knocking Melantha from her feet. In the command quarters of the Night Flyer was a spherical room with featureless white walls, a lesser sphere, a suspended control console floating in its center. The walls were always blank when the ship was in drive. The warped and glaring underside of space-time was painful to behold. But now darkness woke in the room, a holoscope coming to life, cold black and stars everywhere, points of icy, unwinking brilliance, no up and no down and no direction. The floating control sphere, the only feature in the simulated sea of night. The Night Flyer had shifted out of drive. Melantha Gerald found her feet again and thumbed on a communicator. The alarms were still hooting and it was hard to hear.
Captain, she shouted. What's happening?
I don't know, Royd's voice replied. I'm trying to find out. Wait.
Melantha waited. Caroli DeBrannon came staggering out into the corridor, blinking and rubbing his eyes. Rojan Christophorus was not long behind him.
What is it? What's wrong? He demanded.
But Melantha just shook her head. Lindgren and Danil soon appeared as well. There was no sign of Marij Black, Alice Northwind, or Lummi Thorne. The academicians looked uneasily at the seal that blocked Cargo Hold 3. Finally, Melantha told Christophorus to go look. He returned a few minutes later.
Agatha is still unconscious, he said,
talking at the top of his voice to be heard over the alarms.
The drugs still have her. She's moving around, though, crying out.
Alice and Lummi?
Christophorus shrugged. I can't find them. Ask your friend Royd.
The communicator came back to life as the alarms died.
We have returned to normal space, Royd's voice said, but the ship is damaged. Hold 3, your computer room was breached while we were under drive. It was ripped apart by the flux. The computer dropped us out of drive automatically, fortunately for us, or the drive forces might have torn my entire ship apart.
Royd, said Melantha, Northwind and Thorne are missing.
It appears your computer was in use when the hold was breached, Royd said carefully. I would presume them dead, although I cannot say that with certainty. At Melantha's request, I have deactivated most of my monitors, retaining only the lounge input. I do not know what transpired, but this is a small ship, and if they are not with you, we must assume the worst.
He paused briefly.
If it is any consolation, they died swiftly and painlessly.
You killed them! Christophorus said, his face red and angry. He started to say more, but Melantha slipped her hand firmly over his mouth.
The two linguists exchanged a long, meaningful look.
Do we know how it happened, Captain? Melantha asked.
Yes, he said reluctantly.
The xenobiologist had taken the hint, and Melantha took away her hand to let him breathe.
Royd, she prompted.
It sounds insane, Melantha. His voice replied. But it appears your colleagues opened the hold's loading lock. I doubt they did so deliberately, of course. They were using the system interface to gain entry to the Night Flyer's data storage and controls, and they shunted aside all the safeties.
I see, Melantha said. Terrible tragedy.
Yes. Perhaps more terrible than you think. I have yet to discover the extent of damage to my ship.
We should not keep you if you have duties to perform, Melantha said. All of us are shocked, and it is difficult to talk now. Investigate the condition of your ship and we'll continue our discussion at a more opportune time. Agreed?
Yes, Royd said.
Melantha turned off the communicator. Now, in theory, the device was dead. Royd could neither see nor hear them.
Do you believe him? Christophorus snapped.
I don't know, Melantha Jurl said. But I do know that the other cargo holds can all be flushed, just as Hold 3 was. I'm moving my sleep web into a cabin. I suggest that those of you who are living in Hold 2 do the same.
Clever, Lindgren said with a sharp nod of her head. We can crowd in. It won't be comfortable, but I doubt that I'd sleep the sleep of angels in the holds after this.
We should also get our suits out of storage in 4, Daniel suggested. Keep them close at hand, just in case.
If you wish, Melantha said.
It's possible that all the locks might pop open simultaneously. Royd can't fault us for taking precautions.
She flashed a grim smile.
After today, we've earned the right to act irrationally.
This is no time for your damn jokes, Melantha, Christophorus said. He was still red-faced and his tone was full of fear and anger. 3 people are dead. Agatha is perhaps deranged or catatonic. The rest of us are endangered.
Yes, and we still have no idea what is happening, Melantha pointed out.
Royd Eris is killing us, Christophorus shrieked. I don't know who or what he is, and I don't know if the story he gave us is true, and I don't care. Maybe he's a haranguing mind, or the avenging angel of the Volcran, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. What the hell difference does it make? He's killing us.
He looked at each of them in turn.
Any one of us could be next, he added. Any one of us. Unless we've got to make plans. Do something. Put a stop to this once and for all.
You realize, Melantha said gently, that we cannot actually know whether the good captain has turned off his sensory inputs down here. He could be watching and listening to us right now. He isn't, of course. He said he wouldn't, and I believe him. But we have only his word on that. Now, Rojan, you don't appear to trust Royd. If that's so, you can hardly put any faith in his promises. It follows, therefore, that from your own point of view, it might not be wise to say the things that you're saying. She smiled slyly. Do you understand the implications of what I'm saying?
Christophorus opened his mouth and closed it again, looking very like a tall, ugly fish.
He said nothing, but his eyes moved furtively and his flush deepened.
Lindgren smiled thinly. I think he's got it, she said.
The computer is gone, then, Coroli de Brandon said suddenly in a low voice.
Melantha looked at him. I'm afraid so, Coroli.
De Brandon ran his fingers through his hair, as if half aware of how untidy he looked.
De Volcran, he muttered.
How will we work without the computer?
He nodded to himself.
I have a small unit in my cabin, a wrist model. Perhaps it will suffice.
It must suffice, it must.
I will get the figures from Royd, learn where we have dropped out.
Excuse me, my friends. Pardon. I must go.
He wandered away in a distracted haze, talking to himself.
He hasn't heard a word we've said, Daniel said, incredulous.
Think how distraught he'd be if all of us were dead, added Lindgren. Then he'd have no one to help him look for the Volcran.
Let him go, Melantha said. He is as hurt as any of us, maybe more so. He wears it differently. His obsessions are his defense.
Ah, and what is our defense?
Patience, maybe, said Melantha Jurl.
All of the dead were trying to breach Royd's secret when they died. We haven't tried. Here we are discussing their deaths.
You don't find that suspicious? Asked Lindgren.
Very, Melantha said. I even have a method of testing my suspicions. One of us can make yet another attempt to find out whether our captain told us the truth. If he or she dies, we'll know. She shrugged. Forgive me, however, if I'm not the one who tries. But don't let me stop you if you have the urge. I'll note the results with interest. Until then, I'm going to move out of the cargo hold and get some sleep. She turned and strode off, leaving the others to stare at each other.
Arrogant bitch,
Daniel observed almost conversationally after Melantha had left.
Do you really think he can hear us? Christophorus whispered to the two linguists.
Every pithy word, Lindgren said. She smiled at his discomfiture. Come, Daniel, let us get to a safe area and back to bed. He nodded.
But, said Christophorus, we have to do something. Make plans, defenses.
Lindgren gave him a final withering look and pulled Daniel off behind her down the corridor.
Melantha, Coroli.
She woke quickly, alert at the mere whisper of her name, fully awake almost at once, and set up in the narrow single bed. Squeezed in beside her, Coroli DeBrannon groaned and rolled over, yawning.
Royd, she asked, is it morning?
We are drifting in interstellar space, 3 light years from the nearest star, Melantha, replied the soft voice from the walls. In such a context, the term morning has no meaning. But yes, it is morning.
Melantha laughed. Drifting, you said? How bad is the damage?
Serious, but not dangerous. Hold 3 is a complete ruin, hanging from my ship like half of a broken egg. But the damage was confined. The drives themselves are intact, and the Nightflyer's computers did not seem to suffer from your system's destruction. I feared they might. I have heard of phenomena like electronic death traumas.
DeBrannon said, Erod?
Melantha stroked him affectionately. I'll tell you later, Coroli, she said. Go back to sleep.
Royd, you sound serious. Is there more?
I am worried about our return flight, Melantha, Royd said. When I take the Nightflyer back into drive, the flux will be playing directly on portions of the ship that were never engineered to withstand it. Our configurations are askew now. I can show you the mathematics of it, but the question of the flux forces is the vital one. The air seal across the access to Hold 3 is a particular concern. I've run some simulations, and I don't know if it can take the stress. If it bursts, my whole ship will split apart in the middle. My engines will go shunting off by themselves, and the rest, even if the life support sphere remains intact, we will all soon be dead.
I see. Is there anything we can do?
Yes. The exposed areas would be easy enough to reinforce. The outer hull is armored to withstand the warping forces, of course. We could mount it in place, a crude shield, but according to my projections, it would suffice. If we do it correctly, it will help correct our configurations as well. Large portions of the hull were torn loose when the locks opened, but they are still out there, most within a kilometer or two, and could be used.
At some point, Coroli DeBrannon had finally come awake. My team has 4 vacuum sleds, he said. We can retrieve those pieces for you, my friend.
Fine, Coroli, but that is not my primary concern. My ship is self-repairing within certain limits, but this exceeds those limits by an order of magnitude. I will have to do this myself.
You? DeBrannon was startled. Royd, you said, that is, your muscles, your weakness. This work will be too much for you. Surely we can do this for you.
Royd's reply was tolerant. I am only a cripple in a gravity field, Coroli. Weightless? I am in my element, and I will be killing the Nightflyer's gravity grid momentarily to try to gather my own strength for repair work. No, you misunderstand. I am capable of the work. I have the tools, including my own heavy-duty sled.
I think I know what you are concerned about, Captain, Melantha said.
I'm glad, Royd said. Perhaps then you can answer my question. If I emerge from the safety of my chambers to do this work, can you keep your colleagues from harming me?
Caroli de Brannan was shocked. Oh, Royd. Royd, how could you think such a thing?
We are scholars, scientists, not criminals or soldiers or animals. We are human. How can you believe we would threaten you or do you harm?
Human, Royd repeated, but alien to me, suspicious of me. Give me no false assurances, Caroli.
He sputtered. Melantha took him by the hand and bid him quiet.
Royd, she said, I won't lie to you. You'd be in some danger, but I'd hope that by coming out, you'd make our friends joyously happy. They'd be able to see that you told the truth, see that you were only human. She smiled. They would see that, wouldn't they?
They would, said Royd. But would it be enough to offset their suspicions? They believe I am responsible for the deaths of the other three, do they not?
Believe is too strong a word. They suspect it. They fear it. They are frightened, Captain, and with good cause. I am frightened.
No more than I.
I would be less frightened if I knew what did happen. Will you tell me?
Silence.
Royd, if I have made mistakes, Melantha, Royd said gravely, but I am not alone in that. I did my best to stop the Esperon injection, and I failed. I might have saved Alice and Lami if I had seen them, heard them, known what they were about. But you made me turn off my monitors, Melantha. I cannot help what I cannot see.
Why? If you saw three moves ahead, did you calculate these results?
Melantha Jarl felt briefly guilty.
Mea culpa, Captain. I share the blame.
I know that. Believe me, I know that. It is hard to see three moves ahead when you do not know the rules, however.
Tell me the rules.
I am blind and deaf, Royd said, ignoring her. It is frustrating. I cannot help if I am blind and deaf. I am going to turn on the monitors again, Melantha. I am sorry if you do not approve. I want your approval, but I must do this with or without it. I have to see.
Turn them on, Melantha said thoughtfully. I was wrong, Captain. I should never have asked you to blind yourself. I did not understand the situation, and I overestimated my own power to control the others. A failing of mine. Improved models too often think they can do anything. Her mind was racing, and she felt almost sick. She had miscalculated, misled, and there was more blood on her hands. I think I understand better now.
Understand what? Caroli de Brannan said, baffled.
You do not understand, Royd said sternly. Don't pretend that you do, Melantha Jarl. Don't. It is not wise or safe to be too many moves ahead.
There was something disturbing in his tone.
Melantha understood that, too.
What? Caroli said. I do not understand.
Neither do I, Melantha said carefully. Neither do I, Caroli. She kissed him lightly.
None of us understands, do we?
Good, said Royd.
She nodded and put a reassuring arm around Caroli.
Royd, she said,
to return to the question of repairs, it seems to me you must do this work, regardless of what promises we can give you. You won't risk your ship by slipping back into drive in your present condition, and the only other option is to drift out here until we all die. What choice do we have?
I have a choice, Royd said with deadly seriousness. I could kill all of you if that were the only way to save myself and my ship.
You could try, Melantha said.
Let us have no more talk of death, de Brannan said.
You are right, Caroli, Royd said. I do not wish to kill any of you, but I must be protected.
You will be, Melantha said. Caroli can set the others to chasing your hull fragments. I'll be your protection. I'll stay by your side.
If anyone tries to attack you, they'll have to deal with me.
They won't find that easy.
And I can assist you. The work will be done 3 times as fast.
Royd was polite.
It is my experience that most planet-born are clumsy and easily tired in weightlessness. It would be more efficient if I worked alone, although I will gladly accept your services as a bodyguard.
I remind you that I'm the improved model, Captain, Melantha said. Good in freefall as well as in bed. I'll help.
You are stubborn. As you will, then. In a few moments, I shall depower the gravity grid. Karoli, go and prepare your people. Unship your vacuum sleds and suit up. I will exit the night flyer in 3 standard hours after I have recovered from the pains of your gravity. I want all of you outside the ship before I leave. Is that condition understood?
Yes, said Karoli. All except Agatha. She has not regained consciousness, friend. She will not be a problem.
No, said Royd. I meant all of you, including Agatha. Take her outside with you.
But Royd, protested DeBrannon.
You're the captain, Melantha Jurl said firmly.
It will be as you say. All of us outside, including Agatha.
Outside, it was as though some vast animal had taken a bite out of the stars. Melantha Jurl waited on her sled close by the night flyer and looked at stars. It was not so very different out here in the depths of interstellar space. The stars were cold, frozen points of light, unwinking, austere, more chill and uncaring somehow than the same suns made to dance and twinkle by an atmosphere. Only the absence of a landmark primary reminded her of where she was. In the places between where men and women and their ships do not stop. Where the Vulcans sail crass and possibly ancient. She tried to pick out Avalon's sun, but she did not know where to search. The configurations were strange to her, and she had no idea of how she was oriented. Behind her, before her, above, all around, the starfields stretched endlessly. She glanced down, or what seemed like down just then, beyond her feet and her sled and the night flyer, expecting still more alien stars. And the bite hit her with an almost physical force. Melantha fought off a wave of vertigo. She was suspended above a pit, a yawning chasm in the universe, black, starless, vast. Empty. She remembered then the Tempter's Veil. Just a cloud of dark gases, nothing really, galactic pollution that obscured the light from the stars of the fringe. But this, close at hand, it seemed immense. Terrifying, and she had to break her gaze when she began to feel as if she were falling. It was a gulf beneath her and the frail silver-white shell of the night flyer, a gulf about to swallow them. Melantha touched one of the controls on the sled's forked handle, swinging around so the veil was to her side instead of beneath her. That seemed to help somehow. She concentrated on the night flyer, ignoring the looming wall of blackness beyond. It was the largest object in her universe, bright amid the darkness, ungainly, its shattered cargo sphere giving the whole craft an unbalanced cast. She could see the other sleds as they angled through the black, tracking the missing pieces of hull, grappling with them, bringing them back. The linguistic team worked together, as always, sharing a sled. Rojan Christophorus was alone, working in a sullen silence. Melantha had almost had to threaten him with physical violence before he agreed to join them. The xenobiologist was certain that it was all another plot, that once they were outside, the Nightflyer would slip into drive without them and leave them to lingering deaths. His suspicions were inflamed by drink, and there had been alcohol on his breath when Melantha and Karoli had finally forced him to suit up. Karoli had a sled too, and a silent passenger, Agatha Marige Black, freshly drugged and asleep in her vacuum suit, safely locked into place. While her colleagues labored, Melantha Jurl waited for Royd Eris, talking to the others occasionally over the comm link. The two linguists, unaccustomed to weightlessness, were complaining a good deal and bickering as well. Karoli tried to soothe them frequently. Christophorus said little, and his few comments were edged and biting. He was still angry. Melantha watched him flit across her field of vision, a stick figure in form-fitting black armor standing erect at the controls of his sled. Finally, the circular airlock atop the foremost of the Night Flyer's major spheres dilated and Royd Eris emerged. She watched him approach, curious, wondering what he would look like. In her mind were a half-dozen contradictory pictures. His genteel, cultured, too formal voice sometimes reminded her of the dark aristocrats of her native Prometheus, the wizards who toyed with human genes and played Baroque status games. At other times, his naivete made her imagine him as an inexperienced youth. His ghost was a tired-looking, thin young man, and he was supposed to be considerably older than that pale shadow, but Melantha found it difficult to hear an old man talking when he spoke. Melantha felt a nervous tingle as he neared. The lines of his sled and his suit were different than theirs, disturbingly so. Alien, she thought, and quickly squelched the thought. Such differences meant nothing. Royd's sled was large, a long oval plate with 8 jointed grappling arms bristling from its underside like the legs of a metallic spider. A heavy-duty cutting laser was mounted beneath the controls, its snout jutting threateningly forward. His suit was far more massive than the carefully engineered Academy worksuits they wore, with a bulge between its shoulder blades that was probably a power pack and rakish, radiant fins atop shoulders and helmet. It made him seem hulking, hunched, and deformed. But when he finally came near enough for Melantha to see his face, it was just a face. White, very white. That was the predominant impression she got. White hair cropped very short, a white stubble around the sharply chiseled lines of his jaw, almost invisible eyebrows beneath which his eyes moved restlessly. His eyes were large and vividly blue, his best feature. His skin was pale and unlined, scarcely touched by time. He looked wary, she thought, and perhaps a bit frightened. Royd stopped his sled close to hers, amid the twisted ruin that had been Cargo Hold 3, and surveyed the damage, the pieces of floating wreckage that had once been flesh, blood, glass, metal, plastic. Hard to distinguish now, all of them fused and burned and frozen together. "We have a good deal of work to do," he said. "Shall we begin?" "First, let's talk," she replied. She shifted her sled closer and reached out to him, but the distance was still too great, the width of the bases of the 2 vacuum sleds keeping them apart. Melantha backed off and turned herself over completely so that Royd stood upside down in her world and she upside down in his. She moved to him again, positioning her sled directly over, under his. Their gloved hands met, brushed, parted. Melantha adjusted her altitude. Their helmets touched. "Now I have touched you," Royd said, with a tremor in his voice. "I have never touched anyone before, or been touched." "Oh, Royd, this isn't touching, not really. The suits are in the way. But I will touch you, really touch you. I promise you that." "You can't. It's impossible." "I'll find a way," she said firmly. "Now turn off your comm. The sound will carry through our helmets." He blinked and used his tongue controls, and it was done. "Now we can talk," she said, "privately." "I do not like this, Melantha," he said. "This is too obvious. This is dangerous." "There is no other way. Royd, I do know." "Yes," he said. "I knew you did. 3 moves ahead, Melantha. I remember the way you play chess. But this is a more serious game, and you are safer if you feign ignorance." "I understand that, Captain. Other things I'm less sure about. Can we talk about them?" "No, don't ask me to. Just do as I tell you. You are in peril, all of you, but I can protect you. The less you know, the better I can protect you." Through the transparent faceplates, his expression was somber. She stared into his upside-down eyes.
It might be a second crew member, someone else hidden in your quarters. But I don't believe that. It's the ship, isn't it? Your ship is killing us, not you. It. Only that doesn't make sense. You command the Night Flyer. How can it act independently, and why? What motive? And how was Tala Lassimer killed? The business with Alice and Lami? That was easy, but a psionic murder? A starship with Psi? I can't accept that. It can't be the ship. Yet it can't be anything else. Help me, Captain. He blinked, anguish behind his eyes. I should never have accepted Karoli's charter, not with a telepath among you. It was too risky, but I wanted to see the Fulcrum, and he spoke of them so movingly. He sighed. You understand too much already, Melantha. I can't tell you more, or I would be powerless to protect you. The ship is malfunctioning. That is all you need to know. It is not safe to push too hard. As long as I am at the controls, I think I can keep you and the others from harm. Trust me. Trust is a two-way bond, Melantha said. Royd lifted his hand and pushed her away, then tongued his communicator back to life. Enough gossip, he announced. We have work to do. Come. I want to see just how improved you actually are. In the solitude of her helmet, Melantha Jurl swore softly. With an irregular twist of metal locked beneath him and his sled's magnetic grip, Rajan Christophorus sailed back towards the Night Flyer. He was watching from a distance when Royd Eris emerged on his oversized work sled. He was closer when Melantha Jurl moved to him, inverted her sled, and pressed her faceplate to Royd's. Christophorus listened to their soft exchange, heard Melantha promise to touch him, Eris, the thing, the killer. He swallowed his rage. Then they cut him out, cut all of them out, went off the open circuit. But still, she hung there, suspended by that cipher in the hunchback's spacesuit, faces pressed together like two lovers kissing. Christophorus swept in close, unlocked his captive plate so it would drift towards them. Here, he announced. I'm off to get another. He tongued off his own comm and swore, and his sled slid around the spheres and tubes of the Night Flyer. Somehow they were all in it together, Royd and Melantha and possibly old DeBrannon as well, he thought sourly. She had protected Eris from the first, stopped them when they might have taken action together, found out who or what he was. He did not trust her. His skin crawled when he remembered that they had been to bed together. She and Eris were the same, whatever they might be. And now poor Alice was dead, and that fool Thorn, and even that damned telepath. But still, Melantha was with him, against them. Rojan Christophorus was deeply afraid and angry and half-drunk. The others were out of sight, off chasing spinning wedges of half-slagged metal. Royd and Melantha were engrossed in each other, the ship abandoned and vulnerable. This was his chance. No wonder Eris had insisted that all of them precede him into the void. Outside, isolated from the controls of the Night Flyer, he was only a man. A weak one at that. Smiling a thin, hard smile, Christophorus brought his sled curling around the cargo spheres, hidden from sight, and vanished into the gaping maw of the drive room. It was a long tunnel, everything open to vacuum, safe from the corrosion of an atmosphere. Like most starships, the Night Flyer had a triple propulsion system. The grav field for landing and lifting, useless away from a gravity well, the nukes for deep space sublight maneuverings, and the great star drives themselves. The lights of his sled flickered past the encircling ring of nukes and sent long bright streaks along the sides of the closed cylinders of the star drives. The huge engines that bent the stuff of space-time, encased in webs of metal and crystal. At the end of the tunnel was a great circular door, reinforced metal, closed, the main airlock. Christophorus set the sled down, dismounted, pulling his boots free of the sled's magnetic grip with an effort, and moved to the airlock. This was the hardest part, he thought.
The headless body of Tala Lassimer was tethered loosely to a massive support strut by the lock, like a grisly guardian of the way. The xenobiologist had to stare at it while he waited for the lock to cycle. Whenever he glanced away, somehow he would find his eyes creeping back to it. The body looked almost natural, as if it had never had a head. Christophorus tried to remember what Lassimer had looked like, but the features would not come to mind. He moved uncomfortably, but then the locked door slid open and he gratefully entered the chamber to cycle through. He was alone in the night flyer. A cautious man, Christophorus kept his suit on, though he collapsed the helmet and yanked loose the suddenly limp metallic fabric so it fell behind his back like a hood. He could snap it in place quickly enough if the need arose. In cargo hold 4, where they had stored their equipment, the xenobiologist found what he was looking for. A portable cutting laser, charged and ready. Low power, but it would do. Slow and clumsy in weightlessness, he pulled himself down the corridor into the darkened lounge. It was chilly inside, the air cold on his cheeks. He tried not to notice. He braced himself at the door and pushed off across the width of the room, sailing above the furniture, which was all safely bolted into place. As he drifted towards his objective, something wet and cold touched his face. It startled him, but it was gone before he could quite make out what it was. When it happened again, Christophorus snatched at it, caught it, and felt briefly sick. He had forgotten. No one had cleaned the lounge yet. The remains were still there, floating now, blood and flesh and bits of bone and brain all around him. He reached the far wall, stopped himself with his arms, pulled himself down to where he wanted to go, the bulkhead, the wall. No doorway was visible, but the metal couldn't be very thick. Beyond was the control room, the computer access, safety, power. Rojan Christophorus did not think of himself as a vindictive man. He did not intend to harm Royd Eris. That judgment was not his to make. He would take control of the night flyer, warn Eris away, make certain the man stayed sealed in his suit. He would take them all back without any more mysteries, any more killings. The Academy arbiters could listen to the story and probe Eris and decide the right and wrong of it, guilt and innocence, what should be done. The cutting laser emitted a thin pencil of scarlet light. Christophorus smiled and applied it to the bulkhead. It was slow work, but he had patience. They would not have missed him, quiet as he'd been, and if they did, they would assume he was off sledding after some hunk of salvage. Eris's repairs would take hours, maybe days, to finish. The bright blade of the laser smoked where it touched the metal. Christophorus applied himself diligently. Something moved on the periphery of his vision, just a little flicker barely seen. A floating bit of brain, he thought. A sliver of bone. A bloody piece of flesh, hair still hanging from it. Horrible things, but nothing to worry about. He was a biologist. He was used to blood and brains and flesh. And worse, he had dissected many an alien in his day, cutting through chitin and mucus, pulsing stinking food sacs and poisonous spines. He had seen and touched it all. Again, the motion caught his eye, teased at it. Not wanting to, Christophorus found himself drawn to look. He could not not look somehow, just as he had been unable to ignore the headless corpse near the airlock. He looked. It was an eye. Christophorus trembled and the laser slipped sharply off to one side, so he had to wrestle with it to bring it back to the channel he was cutting. His heart raced. He tried to calm himself. Nothing to be frightened of. No one was home, and if Royd should return, well, he had the laser as a weapon, and he had his suit on if an airlock blew. He looked at the eye again, willing away his fear. It was just an eye. Tala Lassimer's eye. Pale blue, bloody, but intact. The same watery eye the boy had when alive. Nothing supernatural. A piece of dead flesh floating in the lounge amid other pieces of dead flesh. Someone should have cleaned up the lounge, Christophorus thought angrily. It was indecent to leave it like this. It was uncivilized.
The eye did not move. The other grisly bits were drifting on the air currents that flowed across the room, but the eye was still. It neither bobbed nor spun. It was fixed on him, staring. He cursed himself and concentrated on the laser, on his cutting. He had burned an almost straight line up the bulkhead for about a meter. He began another at a right angle. The eye watched dispassionately. Christophorus suddenly found he could not stand it. One hand released his grip on the laser, reached out, caught the eye, flung it across the room. The action made him lose balance. He tumbled backward, the laser slipping from his grasp, his arms flapping like the wings of some absurd heavy bird. Finally, he caught an edge of the table and stopped himself. The laser hung in the center of the room, floating amid coffee pots and pieces of human debris, still firing, turning slowly. That did not make sense. It should have ceased fire when he released it. A malfunction, Christophorus thought nervously. Smoke was rising where the thin line of the laser traced a path across the carpet. With a shiver of fear, Christophorus realized that the laser was turning towards him. He raised himself, put both hands flat against the table, pushed up out of the way, bobbing towards the ceiling. The laser was turning more swiftly now. He pushed away from the ceiling hard, slammed into a wall, grunted in pain, bounced off the floor, kicked. The laser was spinning quickly, chasing him. Christophorus soared, braced himself for another ricochet off the ceiling. The beam swung around, but not fast enough. He'd get it while it was still firing off in the other direction. He moved close, reached, and saw the eye. It hung just above the laser, staring. Rojan Christophorus made a small whimpering sound low in his throat, and his hand hesitated, not long, but long enough. And the scarlet beam came up and around. Its touch was a light, hot caress across his neck. It was more than an hour later before they missed him. Karoli Debranin noticed his absence first, called for him over the comlink, and got no answer. He discussed it with the others. Royd Eris moved his sled back from the armor plate he had just mounted, and through his helmet, Melantha Jurl could see the lines around his mouth grow hard. It was just then that the noises began. A shrill bleat of pain and fear, followed by moans and sobbing. Terrible wet sounds like a man choking on his own blood. They all heard. The sounds filled their helmets. And almost clear amid the anguish was something that sounded like a word, "Help!" "That's Christophorus," a woman's voice said. "Lindren." "He's hurt," Danil added. "He's crying for help. Can't you hear it?" "Where?" someone started. "The ship," Lindren said. "He must have returned to the ship." Royd Eris said, "The fool! No, I warned! We're going to check," Lindren announced. Danil cut free the hole fragment they had been bringing in, and it spun away, tumbling. Their sled angled down towards the night flyer. "Stop," Royd said. "I'll return to my chambers and check from there if you wish, but you may not enter the ship. Stay outside until I give you clearance." The terrible sounds went on and on. "Go to hell," Lindren snapped at him over the open circuit. Karoli Debranin had his sled in motion, too, hastening after the linguist, but he had been further out, and it was a long way back to the ship. "Royd, what can you mean? We must help, don't you see? He is hurt. Listen to him. Please, my friend." "No," Royd said. "Karoli, stop. If Rojan went back to the ship alone, he is dead." "How do you know that?" Danil demanded. "Did you arrange it, set traps in case we disobeyed you?" "No," Royd said. "Listen to me. You can't help him now. Only I could have helped him, and he did not listen to me. Trust me. Stop." His voice was despairing. In the distance, Debranin's sled slowed. The linguist did not. "We've already listened to you too damn much, I'd say," Lindren said. She almost had to shout to be heard above the noises. The whimpers and moans, the awful wet-sucking sounds, the distorted pleas for help. Agony filled their universe. "Melantha," Lindgren continued. Keep Eris right where he is. We'll go carefully, find out what is happening inside, but I don't want him getting back to his controls. Understood?
Melantha Jerl hesitated. The sounds beat against her ears. It was hard to think.
Royd swung his sled around to face her, and she could feel the weight of his stare.
Stop them, he said.
Melantha, Karoli, order it.
They will not listen to me. They do not know what they are doing.
He was clearly in pain. In his face, Melantha found decision.
Go back inside quickly, Royd. Do what you can. I'm going to try to intercept them.
Whose side are you on? Lindgren demanded. Royd nodded to her across the gulf, but Melantha was already in motion. Her sled backed clear of the work area, congested with hull fragments and other debris, then accelerated briskly as she raced around the exterior of the night flyer towards the drive room. But even as she approached, she knew it was too late. The linguists were too close, and already moving much faster than she was.
Don't, she said, authority in her tone. Christophorus is dead.
His ghost is crying for help, then, Lindgren replied. When they tinkered you together, they must have damaged the genes for hearing, bitch.
The ship isn't safe.
Bitch, was all the answer she got.
Karoli's sled pursued vainly.
Friends, you must stop, please. I beg it of you. Let us talk this out together.
The sounds were his only reply.
I am your superior, he said. I order you to wait outside. Do you hear me? I order it. I invoke the authority of the Academy of Human Knowledge. Please, my friends, please.
Melantha watched helplessly as Lindgren and Danil vanished down the long tunnel of the drive room. A moment later, she halted her own sled near the waiting black mouth, debating whether she should follow them on into the night flyer. She might be able to catch them before the airlock opened. Royd's voice, hoarse counterpoint to the sounds, answered her unvoiced question.
Stay, Melantha. Proceed no further.
She looked behind her. Royd's sled was approaching.
What are you doing here? Royd, use your own lock. You have to get back inside.
Melantha, he said calmly.
I cannot. The ship will not respond to me. The lock will not dilate. The main lock in the drive room is the only one with manual override. I am trapped outside. I don't want you or Karoli inside the ship until I can return to my console.
Melantha Jerl looked down the shadowed barrel of the drive room where the linguist had vanished.
What will... Beg them to come back, Melantha. Plead with them. Perhaps there is still time.
She tried. Karoli DeBrannon tried as well. The twisted symphony of pain and pleading went on and on, but they could not raise Danil or Lindgren at all.
They've cut out their comm, Melantha said furiously. They don't want to listen to us, or that sound.
Royd's sled and DeBrannon's reached her at the same time.
I do not understand, Karoli said. Why can you not enter, Royd? What is happening?
It is simple, Karoli, replied Royd. I am being kept outside until...
Yes, prompted Melantha.
Until Mother is done with them.
The linguists left their vacuum sled next to the one that Christophorus had abandoned and cycled through the airlock in unseemly haste, with hardly a glance for the grim headless doorman. Inside, they paused briefly to collapse their helmets.
I can still hear them, Danil said. The sounds were faint inside the ship.
Lindgren nodded. It's coming from the lounge. Hurry. They kicked and pulled their way down the corridor in less than a minute. The sounds grew steadily louder, nearer.
He's in there, Lindgren said when they reached the doorway.
Yes, Danil said, but is he alone? We need a weapon. What if... Royd had to be lying. There is someone else on board. We need to defend ourselves.
Lindgren would not wait. There are two of us, she said. Come on. She launched herself through the doorway, calling Christophorus by name. It was dark inside. What little light there was spilled through the door from the corridor.